From NPR News, this is News in No Time, Tony Cox. Last year, the suicide rate among soldiers reached its highest rate in three decades. This January alone, 24 soldiers took their own lives. That's more than the total number of combat casualties for that same time period. Will these startling numbers keep the spotlight on the mental health needs of our servicemen and women? And what are the cultural challenges of psychological counseling in the armed forces and among returning veterans? Joining us now are Steve Yeshin. He is a former Marine who served in the first month of the Iraq War, and Professor Jose Cole. He is a former Marine as well, and he heads up the Military Social Work and Veterans Program at the University of Southern California. Jose, Steve, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you.
Jose, let me begin with you. Why do you think these soldiers are taking their lives, and is there a common thread to their stories?
You know, Steve, the common thread that we're finding among the soldiers who are committing suicide, unfortunately, is age. Many of them are between the ages of 18 and 24. Now, to be able to predict why they're committing suicide is much harder. And one of the things that we're looking at is, and specifically the VA and the Department of Defense is looking at, is not only age, but difficulties with their marriage, concerns coming back home, and, of course, the multiple deployments. We're asking these young men and women to do more than one deployment, which is really unheard of in many of our previous conflicts.
Does it matter whether or not they are coming back from frontline duty?
It doesn't. Actually, what's been really interesting is that we've had quite a few individuals committing suicide, unfortunately, who have not seen combat, who are actually either in support units, and the Army has seen an increase in suicide among soldiers who've never been deployed.
Really? Are they talking at all about committing suicide before they actually do it?
That's a very difficult one. That's one of the things that we're trying to reach out to a lot of young men and women in the armed forces to try to minimize the stigma and to reach out to their NCOs and their officers in the mental health profession within the military and outside the military. A lot of them don't feel comfortable reaching out to the military mental health sector. So one of the things that we're trying to do is really teach them how to reach out to the community sectors and to their family members.
Before I bring Steve into the conversation, I have one more thing for you, Jose. It's this. Is that because there is a sense that there is a weakness associated with any kind of mental issues when you're in the military?
That's one of the issues. I mean, we train to fight, and we train to be tough. And it's very difficult then to switch that mental training capacity and teach them that it's okay to actually feel vulnerable and to be able to reach out for help.
Steve, you served in Iraq during the first 7 months of that conflict. Let's talk, first of all, thank you for coming on. Tell us and share with the audience some of the struggles that you and some of your fellow servicemen and women have had in transitioning back home.
Well, for me, it was coming back to Southern California in particular. Southern California and L.A., it's kind of a hub in the anti-war sentiment. You know, a lot of the organizations who are, you know, very political and active against the war, headquarter themselves here. So trying to get an education and get back onto a school campus and, you know, just kind of – I wanted to fly below the radar, not really stand out. But everywhere I went, I felt like, you know, these issues that I kind of wanted to ignore and put in the back of my head would be brought forth by – you know, self-proclaimed experts, people who thought they knew everything about foreign policy and what's going on overseas when really they have no experience at all.
Well, that sounds like a sort of a socio-political kind of a problem to face as a person coming back and who was there and listening to people talk about what was going on who had never been there, never been in the military. Were there other issues that were more personal that you had to deal with also?
I mean, I can only speak about my experiences, and I was fortunate to come back to a really good support system. I have two loving and understanding parents. My mom is a therapist, which was kind of a gift and a curse because, you know, you don't want to be diagnosed by your own mother. But no, for me, mostly it was just, trying to keep to myself and but before I could start talking to people and you know, sharing my experiences, I wanted to get myself, my personal things back in order and, you know, just become adjusted. And everyone wants to know what's going on, and everyone has questions and opinions. And there was just really no way to hide from any of that. That was the biggest thing for me.
What about in your personal relationships with your friends that you had before you went to Iraq and your more intimate relationships. How were they impacted?
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to justify a lot of the things you do when you come back, having experienced what you had just experienced in combat. I remember in particular one Sunday I was sitting on the beach in Malibu, and my friends were complaining about their dry cleaning not being ready in time to go out that night. And I'm sitting there, and I'm rubbing my feet around in the sand, and I'm thinking about, you know, my brothers overseas who their feet are in the sand too. And, you know, if they would hear this conversation, you know, complaining about dry cleaning not being ready, as like that's the topic of the day, that's what's really important, it would make them sick. And it made me sick. And it was really, and still is kind of hard to relate to a lot of the people who were in my lives before I went over, because there's just this gap now where, you know, certain things that were once meaningful to me are really meaningless now, and things that are really meaningful to me are meaningless to the people who surround me.
Now, one more thing before I go back to Jose. When you are here, how long have you been back now?
I came back from the war in 2003. I got out of the Marines in early 2005.
All right. Did you have, when you came back, difficult time, I don't know, sleeping, a difficult time communicating, a difficult time sort of adjusting to who you are, Steve, the person, and what is important to you and what your values are based on what you experienced in Iraq?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, I pretty much had two emotions, happiness and anger, and there was really no gray area in between. You know, I was either content at the moment or I was very angry. Sleeping, it's not as much of a problem anymore, but it was pretty difficult, especially since I had come back from 7 months of virtually no sleep, you know, maybe an hour a night. Most sleep was during the day for 15 minutes here, 20 minutes there. One morning in particular, my father came in and flipped on the lights, and I jumped out of bed and almost tackled him. Just, you know, certain things startle you. You know, a car backfiring as well. You know, bright lights, loud noises. It wasn't just trying to sleep, but yeah, anything that would really stimulate a lot of the experiences.
So why? Let me ask you then, Jose. Why would we have, if you know, a spike in suicides here in January? What is occurring in the universe that would make this happen, or is it just a coincidence?
I think a lot of it has to do with coincidence. I really don't think that the spike has to do anything with the change in administration or the climate. Now, I do really believe that there could be a spike because of our economic difficulties that we're having in the nation. And a lot of young men and women like Steve are coming back and realizing that maybe the employment that they had previously before going into the military doesn't exist any longer, mostly for our Reserve and National Guard deployment units who are being deployed and coming back. And maybe that stability of employment doesn't exist any longer.
We have talked a lot on this program about the increased recruitment efforts on the part of the military, and yet we don't get in that conversation some of the dangers that people like Steve and others encounter when they come home. Is the military doing all that it could and should in terms of the support for these soldiers?
Well, what we have to remember is that when the individual goes into the service, they're part of the Department of Defense. Once he receives his DD-214, he becomes part of the Department of Veteran Affairs. So really when we're looking at service providers and services when they're coming back home, once they are discharged, honorably discharged from the military, it really falls into the Department of Veterans Affairs and the vet centers and community agencies. And kind of if you look at Stephen, he was mentioning he was trying to do that transition back into education. One of the things that we're really focusing on with this military social work concentration at USC is to provide those kind of skills to healthcare providers and educators to understand that Steve looks like a traditional age student who's never been overseas yet. He has a lot of experience behind him, and we need to help him make that transition.
Steve, I'm going to ask you this. You don't have to answer if you don't want to.
I love when something's prefaced with that.
Did you ever consider suicide yourself?
Before, I mean, I'm a business owner now, and so I would say that nothing, well, that was going to be a sick joke. The answer is no. The answer is no. Suicide's not an option for me. I have a couple of my friends have committed suicide that I served with overseas. A few more are lost on drugs, which I think is virtually the same thing because the Marines that I know don't exist anymore.
Did you know that it was coming for those friends who committed suicide?
You know what? The first one was a big shocker. One wasn't too surprised. I never would have guessed it with either one of the gentlemen. But one was very surprising, and the other one was a little bit less surprising, but I never saw any of it coming.
Did either of them have the kind of support that you had from your family?
Absolutely not. But I think most Marines who come back from combat, or at least the Marines that I served with, don't come back to nearly anything comparable to the support system that I had.
The time is really short, Jose, but I'm curious as to whether or not there is a racial or gender component to who is committing suicide now.
There isn't, although we do see more females attempting suicide, but yet more males are actually committing and completing suicide.
And what about racially?
And racially, we haven't seen really a spike within African Americans or Hispanics or Native Americans. It continues to be predominantly Caucasian males.
Last thing, what do you expect going forward?
What I expect is really what the Department of Defense has really put out an effort, and the VA, is to do more training, provide more training for the lower non-commissioned officers to be able to detect some of these signs and symptoms.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both for coming on. Steve, thank you for going, and thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. That was Steve Yeshin. He is a former Marine who served in the first months of the Iraq War. And Professor Jose Cole, he heads up the Military Social Work and Veterans Program at the University of Southern California, which will be launched in the fall of 2009. They both joined me here in the studios of NPR West. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Time now for our Africa update. This week, Zimbabwe's new cabinet holds its first meeting. We'll get the latest on the new power-sharing agreement. Plus, the International Criminal Court issues an arrest warrant for Sudan's president, and caterpillars threaten Liberia's crops. For more now, we've got Bill Fletcher. He is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans-Africa Forum. Hey, Bill.
How you doing, Tony?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Let's begin in Zimbabwe. So much taking place there. Last week, Zimbabwe's opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, was sworn in as prime minister in a unity government with President Robert Mugabe. We have tape of that swearing in, but let me just advise our listeners, it's a little hard to hear.
I, Robert Gabriel Mugabe, president of the Republic of Zimbabwe, do hereby call upon you, Morgan Richard Tsvangirai, to take the oaths as prescribed by law.
I, Morgan Richard Tsvangirai, do swear that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Zimbabwe and observe the laws of Zimbabwe. So help me God.
So, Bill, the question really was, wasn't it, how much ceremony this was and how much substance this actually was going to be?
Tony, I think it's too early to tell. I think that there are some danger signs, for sure. The arrest of the treasurer of Tsvangirai's Movement for Democratic Change, the attempt by President Mugabe to stack the cabinet. I mean, these are not good signs. On the other hand, I think that we're going to have to just watch it very, very patiently. The world is watching this, and Southern Africa is holding its breath because the country of Zimbabwe is really at a point of virtual unraveling. And unraveling could take any number of forms, including a civil war. So at this point, you know, we have our fingers crossed, but we know it's going to be a very rocky road.
Why? The arrest of Roy Bennett was really shocking to a lot of folks. Talk about why he was particularly targeted. Is there an explanation for that?
Well, I think that there's probably several explanations. The explanation that's been given by the authorities is that there were outstanding arrest warrants on him for alleged terrorism and conspiracy to assassinate President Mugabe. My guess is that what's going on is that within Mugabe's group, there are segments, and I actually don't necessarily want to attribute this to President Mugabe, that there are segments that want to see the situation collapse. And they know that by taking this kind of measure, of carrying out this kind of arrest, that it that the situation becomes very unstable. So my guess is that there's a segment of the security forces that are attempting to undermine this unity government.
Well, that's exactly what Tsvangirai said himself. Put yourself in his position, if you can, Bill Fletcher. What does he do? What steps does he take? What stance does he take in these early days to try to maintain this very fragile coalition?
I think that he's going to have to be extremely tactical in terms of when and how he responds to provocations. I think that he has to walk the extra mile, actually, in terms of living up to the commitments of the unity government. But the other thing that I think is going to be critical, actually a couple of other things. One is that the MDC itself will have to be strengthened. And I don't mean by outside forces. What I mean is that on the ground, they're going to have to strengthen their base so that they are, in fact, a force to be taken into account. But the other thing, Tony, which is very complicated, is that the MDC is itself a mixed bag. It is a united front. And within the MDC, you have people like, for example, Bennett, who are a small number of white farmers. You have, at the same time within the MDC, a left wing. And it's not clear that this united front can hold together.
What do you expect from President Barack Obama's administration in terms of its still emerging foreign policy towards Africa? And do you think that whatever that policy ends up being, that it will in any way change the dynamic in Zimbabwe?
I think that it could change if, in fact, President Obama does several things. One, that he explored when he was a senator. With regard to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, was appointing a special envoy on the situation in the Great Lakes region. And I actually think that what's needed is U.S. political support to the African Union and the Southern African Development Community in working through the situation in Zimbabwe. I think another piece is that Britain broke agreements that they signed in 1979, the Lancaster House Accords, where they were going to provide financial assistance to Zimbabwe to make possible the transition in terms of land ownership. And I think that Britain and the United States need to come through. They, in some ways, in my opinion, are directly culpable in the situation that we face. So we're actually looking for a different kind of policy and intervention by the Obama administration.
Let's end the Africa update this week on this note. We have a couple of minutes left. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir for war crimes, obviously. Two things. Are you surprised, and is he the right guy?
I'm not surprised. I think it's totally wrong tactically. When you have a situation of a sitting leader and issuing an indictment against them, an arrest warrant, essentially, for them, when you are attempting to come to a comprehensive settlement of the political and military situation in the Sudan, this does not help. And if anything, what this does is push his back up against the wall. What does he now have to lose? I mean, it's one thing for him to wonder what will happen when he eventually steps down or is deposed. But by bringing these charges, it does nothing. How are these charges going to be enforced? Is NATO going to send a SWAT team in to grab him? I mean, let's be serious in terms of what's needed in the Sudan, both in the Darfur region as well as in a tenuous situation in the southern Sudan.
That was going to be my next question to you for a really brief answer. What if he were to even be convicted, what would be the punishment?
He'll be jailed. But again, how do you enforce this? I think that there's a broader situation. This is not just about al-Bashir. This is about a regime and a clique that has dominated the Khartoum government. And I don't think this is just about bringing charges against al-Bashir.
All right, Bill Fletcher, I appreciate it. We didn't have time to talk about the caterpillars in Liberia, but if it is as serious as has been reported, we'll be able to talk about it the next time you come back. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans Africa Forum. He is also the co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor, and A New Path Toward Social Justice. He joined us from our Washington, D.C. headquarters. Now to East Africa. In April 1994, Rwanda experienced one of the most heinous genocides in history. During a 100-day period, an estimated 800,000 people were brutally killed, mainly ethnic Tutsis, at the hands of the radical Hutus. Carl Wilkins is the former head of the Adventist Development and Relief Agency International in Rwanda. He was the only American who chose to remain in the country to provide humanitarian aid after the genocide began. He joins me now. Carl, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks for the opportunity.
What were you doing in Rwanda at the time?
You know, initially we went there to build schools, operate health centers, and 6 months after we got in the country back in 90, this three-year war started, so our work shifted then into displaced camps.
It's almost unimaginable what it must have been like to be there during that time. You're trying to do humanitarian work, and you're seeing horrendous things. What stops a person from taking action in extreme situations like that?
You know, when the foreigners were taking off, I don't know, 5,000-7,000 of them, and I talked to them later, some of them said they just never even considered it. You know, I think a lot of times people just don't know when everybody's flowing right that you could actually turn left.
Of all the things that you saw, and I'm sure there were many, both good and bad, does anything stand out for you still? All these years later.
Oh, yeah. Some of it's still just fresh as yesterday. The people who did stay by. There was a young guy three houses down from us where had been an orphanage, and the director and his wife, they evacuated the country. And this young guy who was the night watchman became the director overnight with these 30 little kids, five and under. And Harry's courage, his diplomacy with the killers, his always ready smile, his never down day type of guy. There were just people like that that just still really light my path.
At some point, though, you did have to get away to decompress, did you not?
But yeah, I think probably for almost 10 years I hardly talked about it.
Now, here we are 15 years later. Let's talk about the restructuring efforts that are going on in Rwanda now. Describe that.
I actually had a chance to be back there this last summer. I was just really impressed as I met with some of my old friends and some new ones. There was a gentleman and his wife who'd been hiding in one of the orphanages that I was bringing food and water to 3 months in this tiny little room, six of them. And he's now a high court judge. She's deputy director of ombudsman. And this ombudsman program is just huge as far as I'm concerned. They use a word in Kinyarwanda that means someone who comes alongside you when you're in trouble. I detected again and again in the different people I talked to this effort at transparency. I mean, you know, I was talking to someone the other day saying, we have problems with trusting our government and things like that. Well, imagine if our government had betrayed us to the level that the people of Rwanda had been betrayed. And then you try to rebuild a society where everybody was touched. And I think one of the ways they're trying to do it is through transparency. They sign contracts. Everybody who has a significant position in the government signs a contract with the president himself every year for what their plans are for that year. Are they going to, you know, another 10,000 pounds of potatoes? Or are they going to add another nurse to a dispensary? And at the end of the year, it's a time of reckoning. It's a time of bragging, or it's a time of we got to restructure, or maybe it's a time you're going to be replaced.
Talking about reconciliation, though, I understand that some of the perpetrators of the genocide are living side by side with the victims. Is that true?
Oh, it blows me away. One of my friends, who's an incredible, courageous man who lost his wife during this time, he's now started a nonprofit where they bring pregnant cows into communities that are really struggling people homes. And one of his first pictures, on one side of this pregnant cow is a lady who lost her husband. On the other side is a man who's just released from participating in the genocide. It is just unbelievable that you could not only live side by side but actually interact. And those who have been working through the process, Rwandans themselves, are working with other Rwandans to just even sit in a room. There's a really good documentary called As We Forgive that kind of gives little insights into this personal efforts at reconciliation.
A big change in Rwanda since the genocide has been the increased role of women. Women account, 70%, I understand, they account for the population, the post-genocide population. Talk about their impact.
there's huge participation that is being facilitated by the government for women. And I stop and think often about many of the leaders and, I don't know, the different prejudices, the different struggling we have with tolerance and things like that. I think they're really on the good road in terms of, you know, proactively bringing women into a more active role in Rwanda.
You know, across the continent in Liberia, women played a really big role
Huge.
In bringing peace there. Is there, there's some similarities, I would imagine, with Rwanda.
You know, I haven't heard of the organized ones like we did see there, but always, I think, they've been the backbone of the country, but always in the background, not even allowed to own property. And now with these new rights given to them, we're seeing some real progress.
So, Carl, for you, in a sense, you could say that Rwanda was ground zero, but now you have expanded beyond there to continue your works around the world. Tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, I never imagined when my wife and I made the decision that I would stay and she and the kids would evacuate. You know, I told her 2 weeks max, and this thing can't last more than that, and we know it went on for 100 days, never knowing that later I'd get the opportunity. In fact, last year I quit. I was traveling part-time to schools. Last year I quit my job, and now for the last 12 months I've been traveling full-time high schools and universities around the country, speaking on genocide, but then also speaking on what is it to enter the world of the other. You know, the bottom line for me is genocide stems from thinking that says, my world would be better without you in it. And tragically, that kind of thinking kind of sneaks around in the back of my mind and a lot of people I know. And so, you know, we're looking at ways of not only becoming aware of what's happening in Darfur right now, but also what's happening in our own backyard and how do I view the other and who am I the other to?
I suppose that reaching young people would be the appropriate place to go to try to build a new sensibility about Africa.
I had this girl in Oakland come up to me, and she says, why are you talking to us? I look around the audience here, and the kids sitting on the side of me, the people who can make a difference are people with influence, people with money, and the people sitting by me have neither. I said, it is so much more than you think in terms of the influence you have and the power you have, the sense of passion you have. You know, they haven't settled yet often in high school and stuff. We get older, and we seem to just settle and say, well, that's the way it is, and the edge seems to be taken off. But there at high school and at colleges, universities, they haven't settled for less, and it is. It's inspiring for me as I see the activism that's happening.
Now, does it happen within your own family? I don't know the ages of your children, but I wonder if your passion has been passed down to them.
You know, our three children are 25, 22, and 20, and they're not on the activist list on their campus, but I'm really proud of the way they reach out to people, I guess you could say, on the periphery. That makes me really proud, and I think that's what we need to understand, is that all of us are called to different roles in the way we build community, but the question is, you know, are we really interested in building community, because community doesn't just happen.
I suppose that would be why you had the name World Outside My Shoes as the one to describe what the work is that you're doing.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, Carl. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Hey, thanks for the chance.
Carl Wilkins is co-founder and president of World Outside My Shoes, a nonprofit educational and professional development organization. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Faubourg Tremé is a little patch of neighborhood just outside of New Orleans' French Quarter. Its houses, once grand, now largely crumbling, have been home to generations of musicians, artists, and plain hard-working black folks. Lola's Eric Eli, a columnist with the New Orleans Times-Picayune, fell in love with the community after buying a falling-down house there. He and documentary maker Don Logsdon turned their lenses on the traditions and characters of the Tremé for a new film called Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. They filmed for years before Hurricane Katrina hit and edited their story after the storm. Lolas joins me now. Lolas, welcome to News and Notes. Nice to have you on.
My pleasure, Tony.
You know, I know that you bought the house in this historic neighborhood in New Orleans back in the 90s, and you have a fairly strong attachment to the place. That's an understatement, probably. But what was it about the history of this particular corner of New Orleans that compelled you to dig so deep for a film project?
Well, the Faubourg Tremé is part of the old city. It was settled not long after the French Quarter was settled. So if we're going to talk about the real roots, culturally and politically, it's in this area. And even before I knew all the history, just looking at this place, I was clear that it was a different part of America, and it had a story to tell.
Homer Plessy, I certainly am one of the people, among many others, who know about the significance of Plessy v. Ferguson. And yet I had no idea that there was a Homer Plessy and that he was from this neighborhood. Tell us about the significance of him.
Well, what people also don't understand is that Homer Plessy was a part of a movement that had been taking place since at least the Civil War to try to bring real democracy and race-blind politics to New Orleans and indeed to the United States. After Louisiana passed a segregation law which outlawed integration and travel, and this was in the 1890s, the Citizens Committee decided that they would take Homer Plessy, put him on in the white section of a car, and try to get that case before the Supreme Court.
Well, and we know that the outcome of Plessy v. Ferguson was the establishment of separate but equal by the United States Supreme Court, which lasted for decades before it was finally overturned. This neighborhood, though, it lost its name later on and became part of the what was called the notorious Sixth Ward and turned into literally a war zone during the crack epidemic. And then Katrina hit. How is the community now?
Well, the other blow that happened was they put an interstate through the middle of the neighborhood. And what has happened is that those parts of the neighborhood that are closest to the French Quarter are coming back. People are moving in. There's some gentrification taking place. But they're also longtime residents redoing their homes. But as you move further in the direction of the interstate, we find that things are not coming back very rapidly.
One of the things that really I found interesting about this documentary was that you and the director, Don Logsdon, were filming and had no idea at the time that you were filming that what you were capturing in the community was going to be reduced to shambles by Hurricane Katrina. There were some questions about whether or not your own material was going to survive, weren't there?
We managed to get back into the city roughly a week after the storm, because our tapes had been saved in a vault, but there was no power in the city, which meant that they were basically cooking in that vault, and the longer they stayed there, the less likely they were to be useful. So we got back in and got the material, but we also realized that while we could not make the movie we intended to make before the storm, we had what could be a far more powerful movie, because we had people that we'd been following literally for years, and now had an opportunity to see how they had been affected by this tragedy. Dawn's idea was, as soon as possible, to meet these people back in the city and get their stories, their post-Katrina stories.
One of those people was the carpenter who was helping you, as I understand it, with the restoration of your home, but lost his own home as a result of Katrina.
Yeah. Mr. Trevine was a carpenter who actually was the great-great-grandnephew of the editor of the first black daily newspaper in America, the New Orleans Tribune. And so in meeting him, we realized we had found someone who both lived the history and could tell it. Because free people of color had dominated the building trades for literally generations. And what we found with Mr. Trevine is that he knew those stories and he knew that history. But of course, like so many other people, he had moved to a low area of town. He was still in still in the city proper. But a whole lot of us found out when the federal levees failed that the area we thought was safe was not as safe as we had believed.
Do you remember the day that you walked in to his home before Katrina. It was what was left of his home when you guys went in there for the first time.
I remember that day well. Mr. Trevine had moved to Vermont to be with his daughter and granddaughter, so they drove back to see the house. And even before we went in the house, he noticed that his truck had been flooded and that his tools were gone. And it was difficult to get into the house because the door had been swollen by the water. You have to understand, at this point, Mr. Trevine was in his late 70s. This is a man who was used to building houses and repairing houses. And had he been a younger man, that might have been a challenge to him. But as an older man who was basically retired before the storm, this was an insurmountable challenge. And so much of his story is the story of elderly New Orleanians.
When I looked at his face, it looked literally as if the life just seeped out of it.
That was the feeling that we got sitting there after he had gone into the house. We sort of sat there and kind of cleaned up a little bit and talked, but there wasn't a whole lot to say.
He didn't live much longer, did he?
No, he went back to Vermont, discovered that he had cancer, and died probably 6 or 8 months after that. One of the things that's very difficult to convey to outsiders is the extent to which heartbreak played such a physical, tangible role in people's decline after the storm, and that certainly people had ailments that may have been bothering them even before the storm, but it seems that the psychological and emotional toll of the failure of the levees really was that much more exacerbated. You find people who may have had blood pressure problems all their life suddenly dying of strokes. And we in New Orleans believe firmly that that was because of the pressures brought about as a result of the hurricane and the failure of the levees.
Is that why some people refer to this documentary as a requiem?
Indeed. I mean, we like to refer to it more as a love poem for the city, because much of what we really focus on is not the storm at all. A lot of it is to tell you about how important this neighborhood was, to give you some sense of what it feels like to be in the middle of a street parade in the Faubourg Tremé, give you a sense of what our musicians are dealing with and talking about, give you some sense of what people are writing about. We hesitate to call this a Katrina film. It really is a love poem to New Orleans.
Lolas, thank you very much.
Tony, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Lolas Eric Eli. He is a columnist with the New Orleans Times-Picayune and the writer and co-director of the new documentary Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. Trumpeter Christian Scott is a relatively new voice in jazz who has stepped up to challenge conventional thinking on the subject. He's picked a fight with some famous jazz purists, and for now at least, he's holding his ground because, well, as they say, he can blow. Here's my conversation with the 29-year-old about jazz music past, present, and future. To be quite candid with you, it seems that you talk a little trash.
Oh, yeah, I talk trash.
You know, with your music is concerned, particularly as it relates to your brand of jazz versus other older brands of jazz. You know what I'm going with this.
Yeah,
right?
Of course. I don't think the older ones are, there's anything wrong with them. I love them to death. I just, you know, my biggest problem is with people that are living now, you know, making the same brand of jazz that they made 60 years ago when 60 years ago they did it better. It doesn't make sense, you know?
So what does make sense?
Well, I think what makes sense is sincerity, you know? I know that if someone's born in 1983 and they grew up with the type of musical influences that I grew up with and listened to the type of things that I listened to, and some stuff you can't get away from, you know, like the radio now. You can't. It's just true. If you grew up with those influences, to be playing Bix Beiderbecke solos is a bit perverse to me. You know what I'm saying? Because it's like, how do you relate to that? Because those guys, when they were playing that music at that time, you talk about guys like Miles Davis and stuff, and they'll tell you, well, I didn't play a certain way because I didn't think it went with what I was wearing or the people I was hanging out with. I'm just saying it might seem a little, you know, narcissistic from their point of view, but the thing about it is like they were being sincere about what it is and why they were making music a certain way. So the thing is, to be calling on to these things from these very, very, I mean, almost archaic forms of the music, if you're approaching it in a way where it's not to inform your musical decision making and you're saying, well, this is what it is and everything that comes after that is garbage, then I think then there has to be someone that's on the other side of the fence saying, no, what we're doing is not garbage. And yeah, we'll fight you and we'll win. That's it.
Now, do you feel in any way held hostage by this?
No, nuh-uh. I like it, man. I mean, the thing about it is it's not, I don't even really think about it unless someone asks me about it, you know, because the thing about it is part of the reason people get angry about it, other musicians, is because they know they can't devalidate what it is that I do because I know the entire history of the music. You know, they might be a trumpeter from, let's say, Chicago or Detroit that might have started with Dizzy Gillespie. He can't actually approach me with that and feel like he's actually going to win on any level because I'm starting with Buddy Bolden. And I know it the whole way through. You see what I'm saying?
It's
one of those things where you're not denigrating those guys' contributions. you're saying, well, I've made informed decisions my entire career in life and made a choice to do this music because I realized that it's going to help the next generation of musicians instead of inhibit them.
Let's talk about some of the specifics. Sure. One of the things that I read with regard to you, and particularly...
I like this already. I'm excited. Let's go. Come on. Let's
and this
go.
Isn't about you and Wynton so
oh,
much
man,
as it is
good.
About the swing. Let's talk about the concept of swing and whether or not there's a place for that.
We swing. We do it. That's the thing about it that people are shocked
when that happens. I'm confused.
So here's the thing. It's like I said, you're making choices to do something. Like I said, I'm not saying that those guys' contributions are not great. And I'm not saying that playing that music is a silly or stupid thing to do or anything like that. What I'm saying is when you make a choice to place a value on that and say, well, this is valuable, but everything that everyone is doing from this point on is not valuable, then there has to be someone that says, no, you're wrong. This is valuable. Now, if saying that what's happening during these times is valuable is being construed as saying that the stuff from the past is not valuable, then it's being misinterpreted. Here's the thing. I feel like for the last 20 to 25 years, jazz archetypal musicians and composers have more or less accepted the type of insincerity that's requisite for their musical survival. So with individuality being no longer paramount, you know what I'm saying? It's like you have all these drones that come out and everybody sounds the same. You have these schools that say, well, you listen to Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, and John Coltrane. But they're missing all this other stuff. The thing about it is you're dealing with a system that's designed with a cap on it. The guys that are at the top of the food chain have said, well, this is how you teach jazz, because this is America's classical music, and this is how you teach it. You can't go about teaching this the same way that you teach other things. This is not math. This is human expression. So these guys at the top of the food chain tell all the jazz programs across the country, you tell them to listen to Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis, Charlie Parker and John Coltrane. You tell them to listen to Charlie Christian. And the thing about it is like, if you have all these kids, thousands and thousands and thousands of kids listen to the same things, when they get to be grown men and they're really playing, all of their musical information is the same. So the decisions that they're going to make are going to be similar.
Where did this come from? Because you come out of New Orleans, and there's certainly a tradition of music based there.
Sure.
You're classically trained. Mm-hmm. At some point, you said, I'm turning left.
No, you know, it's funny. I started off left. When someone tells me to do something, I'm always processing whether or not they're telling me for them or for me. If I come to the conclusion that they're telling it for me, then I sincerely make a concerted effort to try and dig into that as hard as possible. So when people were telling me, well, you just listen to Clifford Brown, I was saying, well, damn, Booker Little's pretty good. Why am I not listening to him? Do you see what I'm saying?
I see.
Whereas most kids don't have that type of thought process all the time. It's conditioning. So the thing about it is you have all these children that are coming up and everyone's saying, well, you're just listening to Miles and Dizzy Gillespie, but they're not getting any Clifford Brown, they're not getting any Fats Navarro, they're not getting any Roy Eldridge, they're not getting any Louis Armstrong, the list goes on and on and on. So you're not going to actually be able to take the music a notch up or actually be put in a position where you can actually challenge these guys that have set this dynamic up if you're only listening to a quarter of the things that you need to be prepared for. I don't think I'm the voice. I feel like I'm the person that's opening up palettes so that somebody can come and blow this stuff out of the water.
How does that fight that you're fighting represent itself in the new CD, the live recording from Newport?
Well, it's edgier than the records are. You hear everything happening immediately. It's like it's happening in live time. This is it. People are reacting to it. You hear mistakes. All these things are prevalent in the live recording. So I think it helps with the argument that people have come up with that they say, well, Christian Scott, you know, makes great studio records, you know, and, you know, there's probably, you know, editing going on and all these things, which is not really the case, but the fact of the matter is you can't argue that with a live record. But you can see and hear, and this is in real time, nothing is edited at all, that that band is really playing well.
And I appreciate you coming
back. Man, thank you. I appreciate a really honest, real interview, yeah. Man. Because I don't get it. You know, people ask, you know, I get some of the craziest questions. It's like, I love Prince, but I'm sick of talking about playing with Prince. Like, there's other stuff going on right now.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
I understand that. And you're welcome to come back and see us anytime.
It's all good.
Okay,
I appreciate
bro.
You. All right.
Trumpeter Christian Scott. His latest CD is called Christian Scott Live at Newport.